Hello and welcome to Dialect. This is Bristol's first podcast. Dialect's back at our new Friday afternoon time at 2 p.m. This week, the global arms trade, giving a lecture at Bristol University this week, was author of The Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade. That's Andrew Feinstein. And Jason Yannakopoulos is back to talk about how the coalition cuts are affecting disabled people. Plus, our weekly What's On Guide and Song of the Week from Jeff Sparks. Dialect is produced by volunteers and broadcast in Bristol on BCFM 93.2 every Friday afternoon. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square. Dialect recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch Helpline, aimed mainly at school children and parents. Their number's 01454 318753, and we'll have a reminder of those phone numbers, both for Volunteering Bristol and for Bully Watch, at the end of the show.
Sounds like a signal from you. Bring me to meet your son, and I will bring you to my heart. Love like a signal you call, touching my
Mood Swings. With Chrissy Hynde from the Pretenders there, with Spiritual High. Now, this week in Bristol, we had a book author, a chap called Andrew Feinstein. His book is about the global arms trade, and he pointed out at the beginning of the lecture up at Bristol University that this was the first book for about 30 years on the global arms trade. The last one was The Arms Bazaar, written by Anthony Sampson, who died 5, 6, 7 years ago, possibly, yeah, just I think it was around about 2002, 2003. So this is really a milestone in literature, this particular one. And so now let's have a little listen to the conversation I had with Andrew Feinstein earlier this week up at the Bristol University Lecture Theatre on Woodlands Road.
My name's Andrew Feinstein. I'm the author of The Shadow World Inside the Global Arms Trade. And I'm in Bristol giving a lecture at the university to students talking about the updated paperback edition of the book, which came out late last week.
So what's the difference with the update? What have you found out since the original hardback?
Well, what we've discovered in this book is we've obviously updated what's happening with some of the characters and companies, some of which you will recall, BAE Systems, amongst others, various arms dealers who we wrote about in the first book. And there are a number of new investigations in the book. Obviously, the new UK-Saudi corruption scandal. There's always one of those.
Well, you say obviously, but I mean, we keep hearing about Saudi BAE corruption scandals, and they seem to appear and then they sort of disappear after a while. Have you found any pattern, and what's the sort of detail of this latest one?
Well, this isn't involving BAE. This is a subsidiary of EADS, a company that BAE almost merged with. Up until a few weeks ago, they were in discussions to merge. And this is really about a £2 billion contract for strategic communication systems for the Royal Saudi Armed Forces. And unsurprisingly, there have been a number of whistleblowers from inside the project identifying inappropriate payments to companies in offshore locations. And I suppose those are the hallmarks of these sorts of scandals, that they tend to involve very large, what are called formal sector defense companies and governments like Saudi Arabia, where it's just accepted that bribes have to be paid. And there are always offshore locations involved and quite intricate, what I would describe as laundering of money that goes from the company that has the contract, usually to members of the Saudi royal family. The other thing that I suppose is common to the sorts of cases that we come across is that not a great deal tends to happen about them in the British justice system. So in the case of this one of the whistleblowers, a former lieutenant colonel in the British Army, Ian Foxley, actually took an enormous amount of evidence and information, both to number 10 Downing Street and to the Serious Fraud Office. And it took, I think, over 2 years before the Serious Fraud Office finally agreed a couple of months ago to launch an investigation into this particular case. The SFO obviously has history on these sorts of issues, having been stopped by the Blair administration through the Attorney General, Lord Goldsmith, from a multi-year investigation into what is perhaps the most corrupt commercial transaction in history, the Al Yamamah deal between the UK and Saudi Arabia, worth £48 billion, in which, according to police sources, around £6 billion of what they euphemistically called commissions, what most people understand as bribes, were paid. And Tony Blair closed down that investigation in the latter months of his premiership. There is an enormous reluctance, and it's not just a British thing. Throughout the EU, in the United States of America, in Russia, there is enormous reluctance to meaningfully investigate cases of corruption, misspending, malfeasance generally in arms transactions. And the reason for that is quite simple. The large defense contractors, the BAE Systems and Lockheed Martins of this world, are incredibly close to their own governments, to their own military, to their own intelligence agencies, and very importantly, to political parties in the countries in which they operate. And the issue of financing between defense companies and political parties is an extraordinarily important area. And as a consequence of these sorts of relationships, there is a great reluctance on the part of investigators, whether it is something that is made explicit or whether it is something that's implicitly understood. But there is a great reluctance to investigate these sort of matters. And those prosecutors and or investigators who do so tend to find their career paths curtailed. So it's not a wise career move. So it really takes a few brave and exceptional people to pursue these sorts of investigations.
How's the relationship between these arms manufacturers and governments changed over the years? Because certainly I can remember something called Royal Ordnance after the Second World War, which was one of the major arms manufacturers. What is the relationship like between these bigger companies like EADS and BAE Systems and the Ministry of Defence, the government, the taxpayer?
Well, I think in terms of the Ministries of Defence and the government, the relationship is a hand-in-glove relationship. Senior executives in a company like BAE Systems in the United Kingdom will have high security clearance. They will literally have physical access to the MOD in a way that only quite senior politicians will have. In addition to which, they move in the same circles, if I can put it in that way, which is why we see this phenomenon of what has been described in the US as the revolving door, the movement of people between government, the military, the intelligence agencies, and these defense companies. And there's this seamless and continuous movement of people between and amongst them. And what that means for the taxpayer is that when decisions are being made about what to buy and who to buy it from, and remember, these are decisions that cost taxpayers billions of pounds, these decisions, I think, are as much undertaken in this sort of very close and closed social network as they are through any sort of formal procurement criteria. And importantly, what makes this industry different to most other sectors is that everything that takes place within it is hidden behind a veil of national security imposed secrecy. And this really creates a fertile environment for inappropriate influence, inappropriate decision making, and for corruption and bribery. And that's why we recently found out that over 3,500 senior military officers and senior Ministry of Defense officials have gone into senior executive positions in arms companies over the past 16 years. Now, this isn't as bad as in the United States, where in 2010, 84% of senior officials in the Pentagon went into senior executive positions with arms contractors, the very companies to whom they'd spent their careers giving contracts. But we are certainly heading in that direction in the United Kingdom. So the relationships are incredibly close, and I believe, from the perspective of British citizens and British taxpayers, extremely problematic, because we are getting decisions made that are not in our interests. They're in the interests of this very small, closed circle of people whose interests, I would argue, are often contrary to the interests of most British citizens. And we saw another example of that today when it was leaked that the Defence Secretary, Philip Hammond, is planning to announce the replacement for Trident, which, again, is going to cost the taxpayers billions of pounds, and I believe is both technically, let alone politically, and financially unjustifiable.
There are plans by the Ministry of Defence to privatise that procurement. One of the people, organisations in the bidding is BAE Systems.
Again, this is heading down the route of the United States of America, where defence procurement is a system that was described to me by a senior Capitol Hill aide as a system of legalised bribery, where the companies effectively not only get the contracts, they oversee the contracts themselves. And now, as you're saying, in the United Kingdom, we're trying to privatize every aspect of that supply chain so that we have this sort of military market utopia, what Eisenhower referred to as the military industrial complex, or what he really wanted to say, the military industrial congressional complex, where the companies are effectively conducting the whole procurement process and the oversight once they're awarded the contract themselves. And this has resulted in huge disasters in the United States of America and will lead down exactly the same road in the UK. But it's part of a process of corporatizing every aspect of our society. This is just one of the more sensitive aspects that is now going down the privatized commercial route. I should also mention, the last time there was a major privatization of a military entity, in the case of a company called Kinetic, the civil servants, the public servants who were running Kinetic at the time that it was privatized, literally made themselves tens of millions of pounds of taxpayer money for doing nothing other than taking this entity out of public hands, putting it into their own hands effectively, and running it as a private company. And we paid them tens of millions of pounds for doing that. And the whole philosophy of these sorts of initiatives is profoundly flawed. But in the case of weapons and the arms trade in particular, let's be absolutely clear about what it is causing. I was an ANC Member of Parliament in South Africa from 1994, when we won our democracy. And 4.5 years after that, we decided to spend $10 billion on weapons that we didn't need and that we barely use today, including from BAE Systems. And the reality is that that arms deal, which was riven with corruption, was the start of the moral implosion of Nelson Mandela's ANC. Because suddenly, when people saw the leadership of the ANC taking bribes, $300 million in bribes were paid on that arms deal. And when that was seen by other members of the party and of government, they assumed they could do the same. And it was really the beginning of the end of what had been a very important democratic moment in South Africa. And it's not just about those in South Africa who accepted the bribes. It's about those sitting in the corporate boardrooms of BAE Systems and others, and in the corridors of Whitehall and Westminster, who persuaded the ANC to buy the BAE offering that the Air Force didn't want, who are as culpable. So this industry undermines our democracy, greatly increases the amount of corruption that occurs around the world. It's estimated that the arms trade accounts for 40% of all corruption in world trade. But the greatest irony and perhaps tragedy of the arms trade as it's currently constituted is that it doesn't make us safer or secure. If anything, it's making us less safe and less secure and costing us an absolute fortune at a time when ordinary people simply can't afford for their tax pounds to be spent in this way.
Sounds quite frightening in a way, Andrew, like we've created some kind of monster. As someone that's studied this for at least the last 10 years, could you give us an idea of how we might put an end to it?
There are very simple ways to put an end to it. There are certain technical things that we could do. So, for instance, we have UN arms embargoes, but they're never implemented. And all of these so-called black market or illicit arms dealers we read about and hear about and sometimes see on our movie screens, people like the Russian Viktor Bout, these people work hand in hand with our own governments and the large formal arms companies. And on the so-called government-to-government deals, where BAE Systems will sell weapons to a country like South Africa or to the Czech Republic or Hungary or Tanzania, the reality is that these black market or illicit dealers are used as middlemen. They are used as conduits for the bribes to the politicians who are going to make the decisions. And there would be an incredibly easy way of dealing with that. And that would be to say, by law, in each of our countries and across the world in an international arms trade treaty, that the use of an intermediary has to be made transparent, information has to be made public about what agents are used, what money they are paid, and what work they do for that money. Because simply by doing something as simple as that, we would immediately strip out a huge amount of the corruption that takes place in the global arms trade. There are two or three other very simple things that we could do. However, the key is that for any of these things to happen requires political will. And that is what is lacking. And the only way in which we will engender that political will amongst our politicians is if we, the electorate and the taxpayer, say to our politicians, we are not going to vote for you unless you're prepared to change the rules and regulations about the global trade in arms. We will not pay our tax pounds to be spent for the betterment of BAE and a small circle of arms dealers around the world. It is only when we as active citizens say, this is being done in our name, with our money, and we're not prepared to accept it anymore, that the trade in weapons will change in any meaningful way.
Now, it's obviously a big trade. It's a massive international trade. And it's split up into different parts of the world where there are all sorts of political powers, such as the Russians, the Chinese. These new BRICS countries are also emerging as political powers. And obviously there are some arms that cross those borders. But within each of those power blocks, what are the objectives of the arms companies when they're sitting down with top politicians?
Well, it obviously varies. In China, the relationship between the main arms manufacturers and exporters and the government is very, very closely intertwined in informal ways. The People's Liberation Army has a network of commercial enterprises that produce weapons for export, some of which then become standalone companies, many of which remain within the army's purview. So there the relationship is completely intertwined. So the objectives will be the same as the objectives of the Central Committee of the Communist Party in China. In the case of Russia, it's more complicated. My own view of the way in which the arms trade works in Russia is that the main export body, which is what is called a parastatal organization, doesn't move without the consent of the most powerful politician in Russia, who is Vladimir Putin. So whatever Putin's agenda at a particular time is going to be the agenda of the main export arm of Russia, and the Russian arms manufacturers will fall into line behind that. In the so-called Western countries, the situation isn't actually much different. We just think that our systems are so profoundly different to some of these less developed democracies than ours, but in reality they are not. And one of the reasons I think the BAE Systems EADS merger didn't take place, which would have been something of a marriage of the corruptors, if you will, because EADS, as I mentioned, is currently, one of its subsidiaries is currently being investigated in a corruption case. But I think the crucial thing to say is that these arms companies, as I mentioned earlier, are so closely linked to governments, to their ministries of defense, to their intelligence agencies, that they're effectively doing their bidding as well. And I think that's why, when there is a cross-border merger proposed, the politics of it become incredibly complicated as to who will promote which parts of the business, who will defend which parts of the business, and who will protect them from the glare of legality.
The glare of legality. Yes, Jason, that's what he said. And, I mean, that's a bit of a gobsmacking interview in a way with Andrew Feinstein there, because I think he's, as a former ANC MP in South Africa, he has been at the cutting edge. He was, you know, as part of the Public Accounts Committee in South Africa, looking at the way that corrupt arms deals were actually corrupting his political party and the entire country over a number of years. And I think, you know, it's wonderful that he's, rather than be beaten by that, he's come to London and he's now going around talking to young students about how corrupt this trade is and what the power it has to actually bring states down. So anyway, anything you want to raise about what we just heard there?
Well, I think one of the absolute mass things about that is the whole thing with that. It's that people are saying about how the government creates these sort of arms deals, and then they're taken over by big companies like BEA, and, you know, and often it goes into countries that normally we just frown upon, and then we're like, sort of, we disagree with everything you do. Here's some weapons, you know.
The thing is, of course, that once the weapons are manufactured and sold, then they may also be sold on. And although there may be some controls in London from the Foreign Office about where those weapons go, I mean, famously, Robin Cook, who was the Foreign Secretary under Tony Blair for a while, was trying to get together an ethical foreign policy. You can't really stop people then selling on those weapons to somebody else. One of the other things he talked about there was this whole business of privatisation, and that's another thing that bothers me. I mean, we had he mentioned Kinetic there, this company which was the privatised version of DERA. DERA used to be part of the Ministry of Defence, stands for Defence Evaluation Research Establishment, and DERA was part of the Ministry of Defence. It used to be run at cost, rather than for profit. In order to develop weapons and make sure that the British Army was and other forces were prepared for the sort of technological changes. The trouble, of course, is when you privatise something like that, that you're actually making it one step removed from any kind of democratic process. So we vote for people, but those people are one step removed then from a company like Kinetic. Pauline Neville Jones was the chairman of Kinetic for a while. She was also at the same time one of the people. I don't think she was chairman of the board of governors, but she was certainly one of the people on the board of governors of the BBC. She was also on the new trust, I think, of the BBC. But this is the governing body of the BBC, not the operational executive, the management of it.
Decisions for the BBC.
Strange, isn't it? She was also one of the invitees to the Bilderberg conferences as well. So we're talking about a super elite, really. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's totally inappropriate for somebody who's running a private company, which is doing this kind of work, to do that.
Sorry to cut across you, Tony. I think it's absolutely shocking that you mentioned that Kinetic is a privatised version of DERA. So DERA was something building weapons for the country to keep up with the rest of the world, and now privatised it and given to a private company that is technically goes across any borders and can go anywhere. It can work for anyone.
I got lost once driving across Salisbury Plain. And that's one of the things you shouldn't really do. You've got to stick to the roads. Definitely don't go off the side of the roads. There are little signs saying, do not drive off the side of this road. Something may explode and kill you. And do not walk off the side of the road. So, you're very much encouraged to stick to the roads. But anyway, I got lost. And all of a sudden, in front of me, there's a big sign saying Kinetic. So they had some kind of like research place right in the middle of Salisbury Plain there. I imagine where they were trying out these new weapons they were developing. But the other thing, which is pretty close to home, is the this what we were talking about there was this procurement up at Abbey Wood. This is a massive office employing thousands of people, part of the Ministry of Defence, doing their procurement. And one of the companies that's bidding, or at least negotiating with the Ministry of Defence now to run the bidding process, is BAE Systems, who are also doing the bidding. Now, Andrew was talking there, Jason, about this being a sort of move towards the US system where the defence companies are totally in control of these public money budgets. What's the problem with that? Is there a problem?
Well, on my personal opinion, I see there being a massive problem with that, because you're putting private companies in control of... Well, first of all, you're putting private companies in control of public money, and as I said, private companies are multinational, international. They can go anywhere with that money. They can do just about anything if you're giving them the money to do it.
Well, there's no guarantee either that the profits are going to stay in Britain, or that they will not go immediately to some kind of tax haven somewhere, and that there's not some kind of very clever... Maybe that company's got a subsidiary in Panama or the Cayman Islands, which
is... A lot of them do.
Yeah, one of the other things which Andrew was saying was that the one of the big German arms manufacturers, private company, has set up an office in London, which is specifically there to distance this German firm from German laws. So if there's any questions about whether bribes have been paid, this company will take the rap in London for it, and no questions will be asked in the German courts. So, you know, there's all sorts of methods which are used by these big corporations, arms companies, to avoid the law and to get round the law. Anyway, that'll do for now talking about that. And Andrew Feinstein's book is The Shadow World: Inside the Global Arms Trade. And it's nice to see that he has also got a solution to all this, if only society will bite the bullet. So let's have some music now, and we'll be chatting to Jason about ATOS, amongst other things. Trying to think of a link there with the Christmas song. I suppose the only link is that once all the Halloween junk goes out of the supermarkets, along the supermarket shelves, it'll all be replaced by Christmas stuff, won't it? Anyway, another song there from Chrissie Hynde and the Pretenders. That one's 2,000 Miles. Now, Jason Yannakopoulos is joining me. Jason, this company, ATOS, has been doing a lot of the assessments for disabled people, the idea being that nowadays many disabled people, rather than being assessed for life as disabled because they've got a permanent disability, are having to be kind of recycled through the system every 6 months. But tell us about ATOS. What is ATOS?
ATOS is a French company, and they have a
they had their own model to distribute benefits, which they've done worked in France. And obviously what's happened is the Conservative Democratic government has looked at their system and thought, that works, we should have a system more like theirs.
And that's okay. And it's obviously a private firm. It's not it's making private profits, just like companies like AE4E, who are doing these similar kinds of things in connection with the Department of Work for Work and Pensions. What are the actual changes that are being made to disability benefits?
Well, a lot of the benefits have either been reduced massively or cut altogether. Benefits such as disability living allowance, independent living fund, and mobility allowance are being either reduced massively or completely scrapped, and disabled people are now, if they're unemployed, supposed to apply for job seekers allowance.
Yeah, so ultimately what we're talking about really is these benefits being cut and moved into something called the universal credit, which everybody is going to get who's on any kind of benefit. And one of the statistics that I found fascinating was that more people now who are applying for housing benefit, which is one of the most basic fundamental benefits that people get, often much more than their unemployment benefit or job seekers allowance, this kind of thing. Most people applying for that now are actually in work, which I found quite staggering. It just shows how low paid people are nowadays, and compared to the way that inflation has gone up, their bills have gone up, and rent has gone up. How is this actual change and the ATOS assessments, how are they actually affecting people, Jason?
Well, they've caused a lot of distress to quite a few people. There have been cases where where people who have lifelong disabilities they can have for the rest of their life, people like me, they're getting assessed every 6 months, and for some people it's a real strain on their lives. And even for those who do, get assessed, sometimes they get classified then as not being disabled anymore. And even if it's something quite severe, because they can probably move about, they might have severe autism, they're still classified as not disabled, and therefore able to work. And back in April, the Mirror published an article that said that at that point, 32 people a week were committing suicide because they were no longer receiving the benefits they needed.
Well, that's pretty severe, isn't it? How does this affect the students, though, with disabilities?
Students with disabilities, most students will still get disabled students allowance. That is actually one that hasn't yet been cut by the Conservative Liberal Democratic government, and I certainly hope with all my heart that that remains the case. The only problem is that once they actually stop living on campus and they're living off campus, a lot of them have been receiving other benefits as well. And with these benefits cut, a lot of disabled students might not be able to continue with their courses, because not only do they have to pay for the tripling of tuition fees, these are new ones coming in now, the £9,000 tuition fee, but also they will have to pay for some of the care which would have been paid for through benefits previously.
This does sound a bit bizarre to me, because all the time we're being told there's a recession on. The recession may have stopped. We're not entirely sure about that. We'll have to wait and see if it's going to be a triple dip recession. No one's really sure about that. Certainly one thing's for certain, there are less jobs around, and those jobs are less and less well paid. We seem to be looking at a situation which has kind of got worse ever since the 1980s, really, with a whole pool of the population who are unemployed. Now, with young people in Spain, for example, now it's only half young people have actually got jobs in Spain. So it's a massive pool, and we are heading in that direction. I mean, we're not quite where Spain is yet. I wonder, this is actually very good for big corporations. It's no good for the government. It's very good for big corporations because they have to pay people less, and also it's much easier to sack people when you've got a big pool of unemployed. What do you think about the way things are going? Because it looks as if we're going to have a massive load of people who are all dependent on state benefits and taxation. And how has it affected you, Jason?
Me personally, at the moment, because I'm living at home, I'm avoiding a lot of the benefits, because I've literally, after finishing university, I've had to return home, which is something I never really wanted to do. But now I'm living back with my parents, which means I've had to travel a lot of places, but it's actually but even so, I have to beat my money because I have to pay for all my I travel a lot. I travel to London to visit National Sea Society, who helped me out. I travelled to Bristol today to do this show, and so I'm spending an awful lot on travelling. I mean, my bills per week now are coming out to about £100 worth of travel. And for me, that is...
Well, that's good you're spending that money, because you're helping the economy, aren't you?
I suppose, when you put it that way, yes. It's what really surprised me is that research done with a lot of major companies will say, even ones at recruiting, a lot of them say that, in some cases 8 out of 10 on some studies, and in some cases 9 out of 10 would say they won't employ somebody even if they've got the slightest mental health disability, like depression. Now, say if it's like an inch of that, they won't offer the person an interview. And that I think is horrible. It's despicable. I think so here that's horrible. It's despicable. You're not giving the people the chances that they probably deserve, and it probably doesn't really even affect them that much. In some cases,
it seems almost like people are being turned into a commodity. You know, it's just like, well, loads of people have got no source of employment apart from benefits. The bills are going up. Tough, you know. That's just the way things are, and it seems to be very uncaring. Anyway, what about Remploy? Because that seems to me a bit of a no-brainer. This is an organisation right across Britain that was set up by Winston Churchill after World War II, that for a very small amount of government subsidy was keeping lots of disabled people in work. Now, of course, the government's going to be paying something like 10 or 20 times more than that, because these people are going to be unemployed. What's your understanding of Remploy, Jason?
Well, Remploy were a very good company. As I said, set up by Mr. Churchill. They had these wonderful factories that lots of disabled people into work, and some of the disabled people that weren't being looked at by other companies, and that's really good. But now the Conservative Liberal Democrat government has planned to shut 36 out of 54 of these Remploy branches, and that puts 17,000 disabled people unemployed as a result of that, and these people then won't be allowed benefits that previously they would have got, and for some people it might be enough to take no legs in the round. I think that's a really sad thing. I think it's a really sad state of affairs, and I just plead with the government to be a little more sensible about this and just take another look at it. You know?
Well, one wonders, doesn't one? Because you plead with the government. Are they actually going to listen? I mean, the country has made the Daily Mirror has actually done quite well as with this one, and the Daily, I think it was the Daily Express or the Sunday Express, that was also running a Remploy campaign. They've been saying to the government, look, the figures don't add up. You're actually spending more money by closing these Remploy centres on benefits than you were in subsidising them. So it makes absolutely no sense for taxpayers. It's an irresponsible use of taxpayers' money to close them down. Anyway, look, I mean, it is very difficult and depressing for a lot of disabled people at the moment, particularly Jason. For anybody who is disabled or who has friends who are disabled, where's a good place to go to get advice, maybe online or physically to go to?
Well, I find a good place to go to, first of all, I turn to a lot of disabled charities, maybe some general ones such as Scope, who are always helpful in giving advice, guiding you towards the right thing, telling you what sort of forms you have to fill in. For students at university, I suggest even turning to the NUS, National Union Students, the Disabled Students Campaign. There's Disabled Students of the if you're actually on their page, they have a fair bit of advice. It's quite good.
Well, Jason Yiannakopoulos, thanks ever so much for joining us. Hopefully, will you be able to make it back next week?
Yes, and hopefully I won't have too much trouble with the transport.
Okay. Righto, thanks ever so much. Now it's time for the What's On Guide with Jeff Sparks.
Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 2nd of November, G Baby I Love You will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Also on 2nd of November, the DOT, which is the new musical project by Mike Skinner of The Street and Rob Harvey of The Music, will be performing at the Thekla, which is at The Grove in Bristol. Tickets are £15 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Bellowhead. This English folk group formed in 2004 and to date have released 4 albums, 3 singles and 1 EP. This is from their recently released 4th album titled Broadside, and there's a song titled Biker Hill. Album Broadside. It is worth noting that their third album, Hedonism, which was released in 2010, sold 60,000 copies and became the best-selling independent folk album of all time. For more information on them, you can check out www.bellowhead.co.uk. Moving into Saturday, 3rd of November, Mango Factory will be performing with support from Paven Tarkin at Mr. Wolf's in St. Stephen Street, Bristol. Entry is £3 on the door, and doors open at 8 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, 4th of November, Gong will be performing with special guests at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £18 in advance, and doors open at 7 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening, and have a good week. Take care, and goodbye.
Jeff, did I hear you right there? Gong. That's a band I used to listen to back in my old student days. Yeah. Ages of millennia ago.
Yeah, around about, what, 30, 35 years ago?
That's right. Who of the original band do you know who's is in the lineup at the moment?
I know David Allen is still there, and I think the woman, Jill Smythe, I think she's called.
Jilly, isn't it?
Jilly Smythe, yeah, she's still with them.
Right, well, that sounds like a fascinating one. Thanks very much, Jeff.
Thank you.
And now I'm joined by Linda Davis from the Clifton Amateur Dramatic Society, or CADS. Linda, hi, and welcome to Dialect.
Thank you very much.
Tell us what you're up to at the moment.
Okay, we've got The Demon of Kensington going on, which is our Halloween comedy horror show. It was written by one of the gang, Matthew Watt. He's got another play being performed for Halloween in Bath at the same time. He's prolific dude, and he's actually directing the show.
So, first of all, where is it taking place?
It's a Westbury Park Methodist Church on Northview near the Downs.
Okay, so that's sounds like a quite an interesting. Whereabouts? I mean, is that a theatre? It's a church hall, or what?
Well,
in the church, you can't have a Halloween in the church, can you?
You can have a Halloween in the church. You've just got to run it by God and the church warden. That's fine.
Okay.
So now it's a theatre. We've built a theatre in the church.
Right. So tell us a little bit about, without giving too much away, about the story.
Okay. Well, it's all sort of fine, upstanding Victorian values. It's a love story. It's a sort of coming of age situation. What happens on your first date when people start dying?
Oh dear. Okay, so this is definitely Halloween stuff, isn't it? Tell us a bit about your company, your group. How long have you been going?
We've been going for 2 years now. So we formed, it was a group of people who were at university together. They were in the panto socks. They were all
okay,
putting
on
panto.
You are more of these Bristol University people that just can't leave the city.
A little bit like that, yeah. We kind of get stuck here. I don't know, we get fenced in by the water or something. Can't get away. And you know, you got all these opportunities when you're in university, and you just want to carry some on into real life, and that's what we've done.
So you're recruiting native Bristolians as well?
Oh, all the time. Yeah, we get so many people coming wanting to join us just because we're so new and we're so exciting and open, and really, really appreciate
it. I mean, I've done a bit of Amdram in my time. This is a few years ago.
Please.
Yeah, but the thing, what I was going to say was that there can be quite a lot of politics in, you know, this is one of the things we found, that there were two or three people that wanted to direct everything, and, you know, do you get that as well, or is it not there too much because you're quite a new group?
That is the great thing about us. We're so new. We have proposals meetings a couple of times a year where it's like, come on, anyone, if you want to put on a show, come and get in touch with us and we'll help make that dream real.
Okay. Are you online?
Absolutely, we're online. We're at bristolcads.org.uk.
And you better just tell us exactly where, times and when the performance is on.
Okay, The Demon of Kensington is on at 7:30 p.m. Westbury Park Methodist Church, Northview, on Wednesday the 31st of October through to Saturday the 3rd of November. Tickets are £8 or £6 concessions. And please, we'll see you there.
Okay, that's very much. That was Linda Davis from the Clifton Amateur Dramatic Society. A very new and exciting sounding group. So if you can't make that, you may want to go and have a look at the group itself if you've got a bit of spare time, and even join them. Who knows? That's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 o'clock every Friday afternoon. If you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Thursday or so, Wednesday even, when Dialect goes online. You can sign up to that or download this weekly podcast from our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can find on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. As promised, here's the number again for Bristol Bully Watch Helpline. That's 01454 318 753. That was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thank you for listening. So until the same time next week, goodbye.